Species.
Unite.
Species.
Unite.
If you saw a celiac bowl on a menu, you would never order that unless you have celiac disease, you're right. Gluten-free. But if you see like a Thai peanut rice noodle bowl, that sounds delicious. You're not even thinking about the fact that it's gluten-free. And that's the same thing with vegan. For a lot of people, they think, oh, that is only for vegans. If I'm not a vegan, that's not for me.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Novogratz. This is Species Unite. We have a favor to ask. If you like today's episode and you have a spare minute, could you please rate and review Species Unite on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts? It really helps people to find the show. This conversation is with Katie Cantrell. Katie's the Director of Corporate Outreach for the Better Food Foundation and the co-director of Greener by Default. Greener by Default makes plant-based food the default option in businesses, universities, conferences, restaurants, while it still gives people the choice to opt in to meat or dairy. It's seriously one of the smartest projects that I've ever heard of. Katie, hi. Thank you so much for coming and being here in person. It is so nice to meet you.
Likewise, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Will you just talk about who you are, what you do?
I am the founder and board chair of the Factory Farming Awareness Coalition, and I am the director of corporate outreach for the Better Food Foundation.
Very cool. So I've had Monica on the show, who is now the executive director of Factory Farming Awareness Coalition, and she's awesome.
Yes, she is.
But you started this whole thing. So let's start with that. I want to know like why and how and what like the whole plan in your head was to do this.
I didn't really have a whole plan to start out. I went to UC Berkeley. That's actually where I met Monica. We were in an animal rights student group together, and that's where I cut my teeth on advocacy. We would host film screenings and do food giveaways and leafleting, that sort of thing. And it's there that I became passionate about ending factory farming. I knew that that was my calling. But after I graduated, I didn't really know what would be the most useful form of activism for me. It's such a huge, overwhelming problem, and I couldn't figure out the best place to volunteer and devote my time. And then shortly after I graduated, the book Eating Animals by Jonathan Foer came out, and that was really a life-changing moment for me.
For people who haven't read it or don't know about it, and if you haven't, you really should, because it is life-changing. Will you just give a quick like synopsis of it for like why it's so important?
Yeah, well, what really struck me, it takes a holistic approach to the issue of factory farming. So, you know, this was back in like 2009, 2010. Back then, factory farming was only being talked about as an animal rights issue. And even environmental groups didn't really talk about it. It was seen as
still aren't.
Yes, true. But this book takes a really holistic approach, and also it's a very like beautiful and narrative book because he's a fiction author, and so he takes like a storytelling approach and really brings humanity to the issue. But what struck me was that when you talk about it not just as an animal issue, but as a social justice issue, environmental issue, public health issue, it just becomes so glaringly obvious that factory farming is bad for everyone, even if you don't care at all about animals. If you care about anything else or even just your family's health, you don't want factory farming.
And so you read this book and you think, okay, what are you going
to
do?
Well, I felt compelled to spread the word to people. There really weren't any groups talking about the other facets of factory farming besides the animal rights issues. And I knew from, you know, leafleting at UC Berkeley, like sometimes I would try to hand people a leaflet about animals and they'd say, oh no, thanks, I don't really care about animals. And at first, I found that horrifying as someone who's an animal lover. But, you know, at Berkeley, everyone's got a cause. And I realized all these environmental student groups, all these social justice groups, they would care about this if it were presented in the right way, if it were framed in a way that connected with things they already cared about, rather than trying to, like, force a new issue on them.
Right.
So I put together a presentation based on eating animals, and I went out to student groups and like student housing co-ops and places that I had connections to. And I found my theory was right. People really were interested in learning more. Folks who I knew would never have agreed to come if it were like an hour presentation about animal rights. But when it's about, you know, food and social justice, then they're very curious. So that was the beginning of FFAC.
So then you started going into high schools.
Yes. I had been, you know, primarily UC Berkeley, but then started going into local high schools. And then eventually we started expanding and starting chapters in other cities where advocates wanted to start also spreading the word. So yeah, it grew, you know, very organically. I didn't set out to start a national nonprofit, but that's really what's happened. It's grown tremendously over the last 10 years. So now there's chapters all across the country.
All of it, what Factory Farming Awareness Coalition is doing is incredible. But the high school thing, like, was anybody going into high schools and talking to kids about any of this before this?
There were a few groups. I mean, Zoe Weil and the Institute for Humane Education has been doing amazing work for a very long time, and she was a big inspiration. There were a couple of other regional groups, but there wasn't anyone doing it, like, really on a large scale back then.
Okay. So many people, that's when they really decide, or, you know, you really are opened in a different way.
Absolutely.
It's such a powerful time to be learning and all of this.
It is, yeah. And it's, I mean, it's kind of funny because in a way it plays into like the teenage rebelliousness, because we're telling them, you know, the government's been lying to you and your school has been lying to you. And they're really receptive to that, like looking for a way to, you know, kind of strike out on their own, or they're forming their new ideas, deciding how they want to live in the world. So yeah, it is a really powerful time to reach them.
It's been around for 10 years. When did you leave?
2019, like December 2019 is when I stepped down. I stepped down for like health reasons. I had to take some time off. And I was, initially it wasn't a choice that I made, but I was really glad when I did so, because I mean, Monica is phenomenal and it's just such a different world now than it was when I started the organization 10 years ago. I mean, it's literally a different generation of students.
And how is that different, though? Explain that a little bit.
I think the students, the way that they receive information is different. Everything is so digital now. Even just the cultural references, like, you know, things that were funny and hip when I started giving presentations 10 years ago, no one knows what they are today. Right. So yeah, it's a new generation. And also the landscape has changed. I mean, as you mentioned, still not all environmental groups are talking about factory farming, but thankfully a lot more of them are.
Yeah.
So, you know, now it's, well, when I started, like, people had never heard of factory farming. They hadn't heard of veganism. They didn't know where meat came from or like what it was made out of. It was very, very entry level, just trying to get people to think about where their food comes from for the very first time. Whereas now, I think thanks to, you know, all of the many amazing groups that are doing advocacy and, you know, online outreach, and there's documentaries and there's books, and even in school, some teachers are talking about it more. So we're starting from a higher level. And that's why the work that Monica has kind of invented and is now one of the big focuses of FFAC is taking it to that next level. So it's not just that initial presentation, but it's really building on it and saying, how can we turn these kids into activists in their own communities and really activate them and give them the skills and the confidence that they need to go out and talk to their peers? Because of course, they're the most powerful voices.
And they're doing it. I mean, it's happening. So you take some time off and you come back.
Yeah. I had this moment of, what do I want to do? This time to think about, now I have a chance to pivot. What's the best use of my time? And I was a psychology major in undergrad. Human psychology has always fascinated me, and it's certainly a part of FFAC's work. But I had, because of my psychology background, really admired the work of Default Veg, which is a project of the Better Food Foundation. And it's more behavioral economics, but also psychology, sociology, looking at, rather than like trying to change people's attitudes in order to change their behavior, which is what I had been doing for the past decade with FFAC, this instead changes people's behavior in order to change their attitudes. And there's a lot of research showing that happens. Like, we like to think that every decision we make is very well reasoned and very logical, but a lot of it we're doing because it's habit or because the people around us are doing. And then once we do something, then we form ideas around it to kind of justify that behavior.
Will you give some examples?
Sure. An example that we talk about with the power of defaults in particular, organ donation is a big one. Basically, with defaults, the reason they're so powerful is we like to fit in. You know, we're social creatures. We like to do what most people are doing.
We don't think that, though.
No, right? We don't. Yeah.
We're so unique. We're
yes.
So, but we do. Okay.
Yes. I know. Of course, we think we're all individuals, but really we all just want to fit in. So we also want to do the easiest thing most of the time. Like, you know, I still have the default ringtone my phone came with. I never bothered to change it.
Yeah, most everybody, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But a more serious example that's kind of a classic for defaults is organ donation. So in a lot of countries, including the U.S., by default, you are not an organ donor. you have to actively opt into it by checking a box to say, yes, I do want to be an organ donor. So if you do nothing, you're automatically not an organ donor. And in countries where you're automatically not an organ donor, the rates of organ donations are much lower than in countries where by default you are an organ donor and you have to actively opt out of it.
And it's a huge difference.
The example that we give is Germany is not, by default, you are not an organ donor and you have to actively opt into it. And participation rates are around 15% there. And in Austria, which is fairly culturally similar, you by default are an organ donor and donation rates are like 80 to 90%. So it's a huge difference.
It's enormous.
Yes.
Default veg was around already,
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But you're thinking, okay, I want to get in this.
Like, yes. Yeah, so there's a growing movement of, especially university sustainability departments. We're starting to work with dining halls, but to date, most of the focus has been on getting departmental adoption. So, you know, kind of laying the groundwork and walking the talk, saying, you know, so Harvard Sustainability Office, for instance, was one of the first to do it, saying that at all of their events, now veg is the default. Anytime they host a speaker, have an event, anything like that.
So just for people who don't get it, veg is the default, meaning that's the option, unless you, like the vegans have to do, fill out the little thing and say, no, no, I want meat kind of thing.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly it. It just flips the norm. So instead of having to check a box to request vegetarian or vegan, you check a box to request meat.
And most people don't request the meat? Is
correct.
That?
Yes.
And that's just because why?
It's easier. People don't bother. But also, we want to fit in. And so, especially at a sustainability event,
right.
If you're going to that and you think everyone around you is going to be vegetarian, you don't want to be the one jerk who requested meat. You think
right.
Everyone's going to be giving you funny looks. People want to fit in. So they're like, okay, I'll stick with the plant-based default. And you know, with the default, it's not fully vegan. It's not 100% vegan. It's
right.
By default vegan unless someone requests meat. And it works differently in different food settings, you know, because that works super well if it's an RSVP event where people are RSVPing and checking a box to
yeah.
Indicate food. But if it's like a buffet, for instance, then what we recommend is having a bunch of plant-based, you know, vegan options at the front and then some meat and dairy at the very end.
Yes.
So people can add them on if they want it, but it's not the bulk of the meal and everyone's seeing the vegan options first. And you know, there's other strategies too, but what we see is that people are, you know, going to eat what looks good, what other people are eating. And there is a small percentage of people who are really insistent on having meat. So like with the RSVP format, there was a study they did in Denmark at a series of conferences where they had like the control condition, like it usually is, the default is meat. You can request a vegetarian option. And then they, for the experiment, they flipped it a veg default and they found on average, an 80 percentage point increase in the number of people eating veg meals. So it went from like around 5 to 10% to like 80 to 90% of people.
That's absolutely insane.
It is.
Talk about when you go into a corporation, like how does that even work? And what is your role? Like what are you actually doing like from the beginning?
Yes. So I have been working mostly with tech companies, some finance companies as well. So we go in, often it is a vegan or vegetarian who hears about it and wants to bring this to their company. So they help to make the connections. It's usually the sustainability director or the green team that's the one to kind of take it and run with it.
Sure.
Yeah. But getting the connection, like having someone within the company to flag it for the green team, say, hey, I think this is a good idea. Can you have a phone call with them? That's really critical. And that's something that kind of anyone who's within any company, you can help set that up. And that's a really important role. So then once I am in touch with the green team or sustainability department, often I'll give a webinar, sometimes a lunch and learn, like educational, and it's half about the connection between food and the environment and why it's so important, and half about the behavioral economics research and why these strategies are effective. And then that helps to build support for it within the company.
Do you run into a lot of resistance, or once you're at that point, are most people pretty open to it?
Yeah, most people are into it. I've actually been pleasantly surprised by how easy of a sell it is, because there's not really any downside, because you're not taking meat away from people. They still have freedom of choice. Meat is still available to those who want it. So you don't run into the kind of resistance you do with a fully meatless menu.
I was interviewing someone the other day, Drew Pendergrass, who wrote a book about climate. And it's also about socialism. And veganism is a tiny part of it. It's like a, you know, one little pillar.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked him, I said, you know, in feedback or like in people talking about it, were they upset about the socialism aspect? Because it's such like a loaded word in this country. And he was like, no. The only thing people pushed back on was the veganism. It's like people were in an uproar. Because if you put that on people, unless they're really open, they run for their lives. And it's like, okay, we have learned so much as a movement over especially the past like 10, 15 years in the sense of like, no, offer solutions, offer really good food, offer this. But what you're doing is like so smart. It's literally like you've solved a huge piece of this puzzle, right?
It is remarkable. These small changes, what a big difference they can make. And some of them, it is a little bit difficult because as vegans, you know, we want to label everything vegan and, you know, say it as loud as we can. But what that does scare people off. And there's all of this research showing that just changing the name of a dish makes a huge difference. So I was consulting with a software company and they had a vegetarian hummus wrap. And after seeing my presentation, they changed the name to a roasted red pepper avocado hummus wrap. And sales immediately increased. And even one of the dining people who had been on that call said, I never used to get that hummus wrap because I'm not a vegetarian. But I order it now because I love avocado and it's delicious. So even though she knew what was happening, like she still kind of fooled herself through this name change.
It is amazing. There are really big, simple solutions to a lot of this that we just haven't been looking at as a whole.
Yeah, yeah. Because our environment really shapes our behavior in powerful ways. And it, like a great analogy that my friend came up with is, you know, if you saw a celiac bowl on a menu, you would never order that unless you have celiac disease, you're gluten-free. But if you see like a Thai peanut rice noodle bowl, that sounds delicious. You're not even thinking about the fact that it's gluten-free. And that's the same thing with vegan. For a lot of people, they think, oh, that is only for vegans. If I'm not a vegan, that's not for me. Whereas if you label it with the flavors and the taste, then...
That is so true. I honestly don't think I would get the celiac.
Right? Yeah, of course. I wouldn't. Yeah. And that's how a lot of people feel about vegan.
Right now, you're going into corporations and that's started, right?
Yes. So we just finished our first pilot. We're still waiting for PR legal sign off, so I can't officially say who the company is, but it is a household name, a big tech company that the folks would recognize. We did a 3-month pilot in their San Francisco office, so we did a few different interventions. They have free food for everyone, so it's just a big like cafeteria kind of buffet setup. So they have 8 entrees every day. And when we went in, 5 of them were meat-based and 3 of them were vegetarian, vegan. And so slowly over time, we flipped that. So eventually they had 5 veg options and 3 meat options. And basically the amount of meat that was being served per person was cut almost in half. And no one even noticed because we slowly transitioned it over time. Still 3 meat options, which is plenty you know, for anyone who really wants meat to choose from. Right. But a lot of people are going to, you know, their favorite. There's like, you know, a Latin American station, an Asian station, a comfort food station. So they're still getting the flavors they like. They're just vegetarian, vegan, and they aren't even necessarily thinking about that.
A long-term benefit of all this, too, is you're going to have a lot healthier companies.
Yes. Right? Yeah.
And are they talking about that, too?
Yeah. I mean, we've mostly been taking it from a sustainability angle and working with companies that are really aggressively trying to cut their carbon footprint. But of course, that is another huge benefit, too, sure. A healthier workforce and less sick days, lower insurance costs, lots of benefits.
Is Default Veg going other places right now, too, or aside from corporations?
Yes. So my colleague Alana works primarily with universities and then jointly, we manage events, so we are also working with some events. The Clean Med Conference recently went Default Veg. Green Biz, they actually did a conference that was 100% vegetarian, 75% vegan. I think their next conferences will be Default Veg, just to make sure there's something for everyone. You know, those few people who really insist on their meat, they have it. So we're working with conferences as well, and then starting to work some with healthcare.
Healthcare meaning hospitals?
Yes.
Because there's nobody who hasn't been in the hospital or visited somebody in the hospital while they're getting their meal and been horrified.
Yes.
Like, the hospital food is so ridiculously, not only unappetizing, but unhealthy. You would think they would want this, right?
Yes, you would think so.
Very cool.
Yeah.
For hospitals, you're just starting. Is it hospital by hospital, or how does that work?
So for pretty much all of the institutions, it really starts with those connections, because it takes a motivated person within the institution to help make it happen. As an outsider coming in, I can't just come in and tell them you need to do this. There needs to be, you know, an ally on the inside. And so that's really key, is finding those people.
Yeah.
And then finding the institutions that are already motivated to do this. And, you know, like I said, I've been pleasantly surprised at how open a lot of them are. Most of them are saying, yeah, we know we need to cut our carbon footprint. We're already having employees ask for plant-based options. So, hey, if you can do this, it's free. Also, right now, we're not charging anything.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And then, you know, we can show now at the tech company, we did surveys before and after, and diner satisfaction didn't change. So if they can say, hey, if our employees are going to be just as happy with the food, it doesn't cost us anything, there's really no downside. And no. So it's a
and
pretty
is it
easy
hard
sell.
For them to shift, like, in bringing in plant-based, like, change? People have a hard time with change often.
Yeah.
Like, is that part hard?
Yeah. I mean, and that another key thing is finding chefs who are really on board, because, of course, the food has to taste good. That is also key to its success. So the company that we worked with had a phenomenal chef, like, really top-notch food service. And the chef there was frankly skeptical at the beginning. She didn't tell me that until later, but she comes from a very traditional culinary meat-heavy background, and she thought people would be really angry if there wasn't meat at every station. But she's a brilliant chef and loves experimenting, and so she went out, bought all these vegan cookbooks, learned all of these new recipes, and really, like, gave it her all. And so the food was fantastic, and that's a huge part of the reason that people weren't upset.
That's what I was thinking. This would be a lot harder to have done 20 years ago.
Yes,
there's just so much good food.
Absolutely,
now, if you have a good chef.
Yeah,
it's yeah, for sure. But it's happening, and you're getting in there. And then at one point, are schools going to be on?
Well, I mean, universities certainly are doing it. Right. We're not working with K-12 schools right now. It's just such a hard nut to crack.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many bureaucratic regulations to school foods and, you know, the protein content and what's subsidized and what they can source and purchase. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's kind of a nightmare. I really admire people who are doing work in that space, but it's a much heavier lift than working with universities and corporations.
With universities, eventually it's going to be cafeterias too. That's like
yes.
the plan.
Yeah, we actually are working on a pilot in the fall with a major food service management company at three different universities, looking at having a station in the dining hall where some days it will be like usual, where you have a meat and a veg option, and then some days you'll have a veg option and there will be a little sign that says you can request meat. Because this is such a cutting edge strategy that really came out of academia, there are studies of this, but a lot of them are just very small audiences, kind of sometimes it's surveys about like hypothetical food choices. It's not even actually people choosing the food. So we've really been working on proof of concept. And this tech company, they're the first major corporation to try this strategy. And in addition to what I talked about changing the ratios, they also did an oat milk default in their coffee bar. So now if you go up and order a latte, it's automatically made with oat milk rather than being made with cow milk.
I love it. That should be everywhere.
Yeah.
That is incredible.
Yeah.
Has anything really shocked you since you started all this, like just with human psychology and how people respond?
It was what I was hoping for, but to see it all play out with that major tech company, you know, I had read these smaller studies, but it is a little bit nerve-wracking to say, is this really going to work on a larger scale? Is this actually all true? And to see that people, really often don't even notice, let alone complain, like that there's no pushback. It's just, it's funny because, you know, something like a Meatless Mondays, if you think about it, that's one day out of the week. So it's like, you know, changing a fifth of the food. And that tends to get huge pushback because people don't like having options taken away from them. Whereas this can result in like, you know, a 50, 80% increase in the amount of veg food, and it doesn't get pushback, even though it's a much more drastic intervention than these other ones because of that human psychology component and making sure that, you know, there's freedom of choice still. That's the key part. Then, people aren't upset.
What have you learned throughout all of this about like individual, like the psychology on vegans, like helping other people like see the plant-based options in the world versus preaching?
Yeah, it is. It's a bit of a double-edged sword, and it's kind of funny because the work and the approach I'm doing now is the polar opposite of what I was doing with FFAC.
Yes. Yeah.
So I've done both sides of it and I see the benefits to both sides. So far, the work that we're doing has mostly been like stealth implementation. So we don't even tell people that we're doing it. We just gradually change. They don't even notice. They're fine with it. And so in terms of like supply and demand, it's hugely impactful. But, you know, of course, we do also eventually want people to know that they're eating vegan food and enjoying it, because eventually we want it to change not only their behavior, but also their attitudes.
Right.
So, but, you know, right now, as I mentioned, you know, we're getting proof of concept. This is very new. And so showing that it works on a large scale is the first step. And yeah. We've done that. We're in the process of doing that. It's powerful and it's really exciting. And then we'll be able to build on that and say, okay, now what happens if we add in some education on top of that, you know, doing...
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, having signage, that sort of thing. But it's funny because actually I was on a panel, there was an eCornell webinar on hospitality, and it was myself and, I'm blanking on her name. She's really wonderful. And she runs a consulting company that helps hotels primarily to cater to vegan clientele. And our recommendations were the opposite, because her target audience is vegans. And so her recommendation was have a separate vegan menu, call everything vegan, say that word as often as you can. And it's true, that's what draws vegans, right?
Sure.
Like, I'm here in New York for a little bit. I'm looking for vegan restaurants. I'm looking for vegan menus.
I'll give you a list.
Thank you, yeah. Whereas for me, my target audience is omnivores. And so, you know, the like flexitarians or reducitarians, we're trying to get outside of this mindset that vegan food is just for vegans. And so for that audience, you don't want to say vegan and you don't want to have a separate menu. You just want to make it seem like the norm and not anything different. So it is a bit of a double-edged sword between like getting people to eat the food and building the movement around veganism and that word.
Right.
Yeah.
And what about the word plant-based? Does that turn people off too?
You know, we're actually struggling with this right now because there's a lot of conflicting research on which terms are better to appeal to which audience. So for a long time, the studies and kind of the prevailing wisdom was that vegan is too radical of a word. That's a turnoff. Say plant-based to appeal to a mainstream omnivore audience. But lately, there's more data showing that vegan is actually the more common search term that people use. And I think, and other people said, it's because it means more. Because plant-based has become, it's almost kind of like greenwashy. Like,
yeah. You
know, I saw someone posted the other day, it was a plant-based chicken bowl, but it was real chicken. Literally the bowl was plant-based.
Oh,
it was like a compostable, like corn, like packaging with meat inside of it. And they were advertising that as plant-based. So I think consumers are starting to recognize that plant-based is a sort of wishy-washy term. So I don't know. It's tricky. And again, it really depends on who you're trying to appeal to.
So, okay. Lay out the future and lay out. I'm just, the reason I'm so excited is because, first of all, this is like the smartest thing ever. It is. It's like, oh, wait. It's so simple. Switch it.
Exactly.
In terms of moving the needle and numbers, it's brilliant.
Thank you. Yeah, it's exciting.
So I want you everywhere. Schools, hospitals, universities. That should be every wedding. That should
absolutely.
What's the path for growth?
We're growing, honestly, much faster than we anticipated. We're working on much larger pilots with much larger companies and institutions than we anticipated. I mean, I've only been doing this work for a year, and we've already finished a pilot with like a household name tech company and working with some other big names and large institutions. Those we're hoping to be able to go public within the next like 3 to 6 months. And we're doing a couple of other pilots that we'll have really great data from. And so once we can really show proof of concept and especially get media coverage, then we're really hoping that this will just take off like wildfire. And we'll probably be looking, hoping to expand our team. Because like you said, I mean, the opportunities are almost endless. And
right.
So yeah, figuring out like how to scale and reach all
of
those
upsides are endless. I mean, I think once all this is out there and people are doing it and it's really, out of pilot into real life happening at work and hospitals and universities, the upsides people are going to realize, aside from their carbon footprint and people are healthier, it kind of changes everything.
It does. And that's really what drew me to it initially and excited me about it from that psychology perspective. I've tabled at so many veg fests and veg events over the years with FFAC. And so often people will come up to me and say, I went vegan for my health because my doctor told me I needed to. I had heart disease, what have you. After I went vegan, then I started learning about the animals. And now I really care about the animals. And that's exactly that the difference between attitude driving behavior versus behavior driving attitudes. That someone who's eating only meat every meal, like many Americans do, talking about veganism is very threatening to them because how would I eat? All everything I know, you're trying to take that away from me. So the stakes are much higher and they're much more resistant to it rather than someone who is eating vegan meals every day at work. And then you try to talk to them about why we need to end factory farming. And they're like, okay, yeah, you know, I eat plant-based. That doesn't sound so radical. So it kind of eases people into it. And I think lowers the bar for then changing their attitudes and introducing, you know, all these different types of activism and really introducing them also to the animal component as well.
So if somebody wants like their company to do this, do they just get in touch with you? How does that work?
Yeah. So they can email me at katie@betterfoodfoundation.org or our website is greenerbydefault.com. We have a lot of resources there. We have one pagers that folks can take to their, you know, sustainability director or just get in touch with me and I would love to help folks bring this to their institution.
That's awesome. Thank you for this. It's one of the most exciting things I think happening in this space in terms of what is going to come from it. So thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
To learn more about Katie, to learn about Greener by Default and the Better Food Foundation, go to our website, speciesunite.com. We will have links to everything. We're on Facebook and Instagram at Species Unite. If you have a spare moment and could do us a favor, please subscribe, rate, review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. It really helps people find the show. If you would like to support Species Unite, we would greatly appreciate it. Go to our website, speciesunite.com, and click donate. I would like to thank everyone at Species Unite, including Gary Knudsen, Caitlin Pierce, Amy Jones, Paul Healy, Santina Polke, Bethany Jones, and Anna Kallner, who wrote and performed today's music. Thank you for listening. Have a wonderful day.